Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to start off this week with another completely trivial article. Some information that in no way will change any facet of your life, but you may find it entertaining. Here's the first article, and it's on Super Bowl food, the snack of choice. It's from Fortune magazine, dated February 9th, by Melissa Hoffner. Americans projected to eat 1.48 billion chicken wings for Super Bowl. The Super Bowl is known to be one of the most insatiable days of the year across the United States. Americans consume roughly 2,000 calories in the 3 hours of the championship NFL game, according to one expert estimate, ahead of the last Seahawks-Patriots matchup in 2014. Powering that snacky consumption? Chicken wings. On January 30th, 2026, the National Chicken Council released its annual Chicken Wings Report, projecting Americans to eat 1.48 billion chicken wings while watching the Patriots and Seahawks compete for the Lombardi Trophy. 2026 chicken wing consumption estimate shows an increase of about 10 million chicken wings from the 1.38 billion wings enjoyed during last year's game. Football is for food, said NCC spokesperson Tom Super, especially when it comes to the Super Bowl, where wings rule the roost, no pun intended. For few football fans looking to add protein to their spreads at an affordable price, wings are the king of Super Bowl menus. During the four-week NFL playoff season in late December and early January, chicken wing sales surged nationally 19.8% versus the same period last year, with spend on chicken wings up just 11.4% versus the prior period. Retail prices for fresh chicken wings are down 2.8% year over year, with the average retail price at $3.47 per pound, according to Wells Fargo's Super Bowl Food Report. Part of the decrease in cost is due to the U.S. boiler producers boosting domestic chicken production by 2.2% in 2025, which was possible in part due to lower feed costs, according to the USDA. And yes, protein maxing is very in. Those looking to serve fresh veg at their Super Bowl viewings may see a higher price tag. Wells Fargo reports produce price hikes that include cherry tomatoes up 2%, celery up 2.6%, and broccoli and cauliflower up 4%. What 1.48 billion chicken wings look like? Do you have trouble envisioning 1.48 billion drumettes and flats? A billion is a tough number to mentally process. This holds true for money as well. But a few visuals may help explain how many chicken wings almost a billion and a half is. According to the NCC, 1.48 billion chicken wings laid end to end would stretch about 27 times from the Patriots' home at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, to the Seahawks Stadium at Lumen Field in Seattle, Washington. That's a 2,487-mile trip one way times 27. Need a bigger visual. 1.48 billion chicken wings could circle the planet Earth almost three times. That's an equator three stacks deep of chicken wings. To consume this many chicken wings, a single person would have to eat one wing every 30 seconds since the fall of the Roman Empire. No time machine? Start now. Eat one wing every 30 seconds, and you'll finish around the year 3,430. Logistically, moving this many wings would require 3,400 fully loaded semi-trucks, creating a 40-mile-long truck parade of just wings. The good news, individuals don't have to worry about those logistics. With over 100 million omnivorous viewers predicted to tune in to the big game and snack, Americans will eat, on average, just four chicken wings each. Wings will be available in plenty. They'll be affordable, and they'll be delicious, Super added. Now, there are many economic ramifications to the Super Bowl, and here's another one, gambling. Here's an article by Nick Lichtenberg from Fortune magazine dated February 10th. America's new love affair with gambling drives Kashi to $871 million haul on Super Bowl Sunday. America's new love affair with gambling reached a crescendo on Super Bowl Sunday when federally regulated prediction market Kashi processed an eye-popping $871 million in trading volume, most of it tied to the NFL's biggest game of the year. The haul capped a weekend that also saw the Seattle Seahawks beat the New England Patriots 29-13. But the more telling scoreline may have been the one between old line sportsbooks and a new generation of finance-flavored betting apps. The gambling revolution took off around 2018 when platforms such as DraftKings and FanDuel rode a wave of state-by-state legalization, and the old stigma separating professional sports and gambling broke away dramatically. Long a feature of European soccer, with gambling sites sponsoring football clubs' kits, the paddy powerization of America led to gambling partnerships with sports brands including ESPN, the NBA, and the NFL. Now, data from Wall Street analysts and industry researchers suggest the grip of the sportsbook is loosening as Americans flock to events contracts on exchanges, such as Kalshi and its crypto-native rival, Polymarket, which lets users wager on everything from playoff results to interest rate cuts and presidential politics. On Kalshi, sports-linked contracts have shifted from an experiment to the center of the business, with football alone accounting for roughly 90% of all trading volume in recent months. Super Bowl weekend showed how far that shift has gone. According to a Bank of America global research note, Kalshi's $871 million in notional volume leading up to and on Sunday was mostly tied to the NFL game. Kalshi confirmed to Fortune that total volume in all markets related to the game was over $1 billion. According to B of A estimates, nearly one-fifth of that action came via parlays, multi-leg sequences familiar to sportsbook customers, but now wrapped in the language of derivatives and trading. At the same time, DraftKings, Flutter Entertainment's FanDuel, and other gambling stocks have stumbled, pressured by evidence that a meaningful slice of handle is migrating to prediction markets even during what should be a peak season for traditional books. Kalshi's business has grown from a niche prediction market into a multi-hundred-million-dollar revenue, multi-billion-dollar volume exchange in just a few years, with growth rates in the triple and even quadruple digits. Estimated revenue grew from roughly $1.8 million in 2023 to about $24 million in 2024, over 1,200% year over year, then to about $260 million in 2025. The company's valuation rose to around $11 million by late 2025, followed by a billion-dollar funding round. According to Kalshi, it is different from sports betting due to the way its exchange operates on a structural level. Unlike a sportsbook, which takes the other side of a bet from customers, Kalshi is an exchange where people on both sides of the trades can meet, similar to the way that stock and derivative exchanges work, a representative told Fortune. Where sports betting operates like a casino, with everyone playing against the house. Kalshi states that it works like the stock market, with customers trading against other customers, and importantly, Kalshi doesn't win when its customers lose. The appeal is partly economic and partly cultural. Kalshi and Polymarket pitch themselves not as casinos, but as exchanges where users trade contracts that look and feel like financial instruments, With prices moving in real time and positions that could be opened and closed like stocks, backers from Sequoia Capital to Rounders Fund described these platforms as truth machines, arguing that tying money to political and economic outcomes produces sharper forecasts than polls or pundits. In practice, that lofty framing coexists with a very old impulse, the desire to sweat a game, an election, or even a celebrity rumor with some cash on the line. Super Bowl Sunday, with its wall-to-wall betting culture and party atmosphere, gave prediction markets a perfect stage. In a recent podcast appearance on SoFi's The Important Part, attended by Fortune, Tom Lee, a fund strat, argued that prediction markets are actually really useful because it's the closest thing to a crystal ball. For users, however, he said it's clearly a form of gambling, and there's a social consequence to that. He argued that it's really a big innovation for the financial industry, as it can help break down the act of buying stock into tokenized earning streams that extend far into the future. Then it's a lottery ticket for you, he said, because if that cheap future option beats, you can make a lot more money than buying the whole company as a stock. Of course, with that innovation and speculation, it creates winners and losers. But that's capitalism, right? Lee noted that 90% of publicly traded companies since the 1970s have fallen in value by more than 50%, and another 90% of those have fallen to zero, meaning 90% of 90% of stocks are eventually worth nothing. Lee's co-panelist, Michael Lewis, author of The Big Short, begged to differ. It sounds like a good thing, he said, but it doesn't look to me like the stock market's saner than it was before sports gambling became legal. Lewis marveled at the way the country has just flipped on this subject and highlighted the distinction between state-regulated sports gambling and prediction markets such as Kalshi and Polymarket, which are not. Kalshi, in particular, has surfed a regulatory situation that treats its offerings as CFCT-regulated events contracts, distinct from state-licensed gambling. Even as state regulators bristle at what looks to many like sports betting by another name, the company has raced to lock in distribution, securing a high-profile partnership with retail brokerage Robinhood that pipes its markets directly into mainstream trading apps used by millions of Americans. On Sunday night, Kalshi's own mobile app briefly hit the number two spot in the U.S. App Store, ahead of most social and entertainment mainstays, while DraftKings ranked fifth, an indication of how quickly prediction markets have moved from niche curiosity to mass consumer product. What unites both companies is the bet that America's newly normalized relationship with gambling is durable enough to support an entirely new asset class. During the 2024 Trump-Harris race, users wagered more than $3 billion on prediction platforms, and the contract's implied odds proved more accurate than many high-profile polls. Since then, Kalshi's busiest markets have ranged from New York City's mayoral race to March Madness brackets, with a single NCAA tournament reportedly drawing over $500 million in bets. To Michael Lewis, even the sports leagues now are privately admitting that sports gambling is the work of the devil, noting all the sponsorships that are funding sports broadcasting and leagues. Lewis said there's a major problem with the business model. It's now the chief engine of growth. It's corrupting sports. It is creating horrible incentives. He bemoaned the wave of scandals, especially in college basketball, and predicted it would keep happening until prop betting on college sports was banned. To Lewis's point, NCAA President Charlie Baker called on state gambling commissions just this past January, urging them to adjust state laws and regulations to eliminate gambling on individual prop bets and other high-risk prop bets, such as first-half unders. Hours earlier, federal prosecutors had announced multiple indictments in a sports betting investigation involving college basketball. Kalji previously responded to criticism from Baker by noting that it is federally regulated, governed by the Commodity Exchange Act and its hundreds of regulations. We, as a company, also have comprehensive internal policies to address trading integrity and responsibility issues, including in-house and third-party surveillance systems that monitor trading activity, Kalji said. We run know-your-customer checks on everyone who trades on our platform. Lewis said he expected the government would eventually catch up to this issue, but we're going to look back on a period of it was not good for the society. It's not fashionable to talk that way. It's especially predatory toward young men. It's young men who do it, and overwhelmingly, it's a young male marketplace. Lewis said he agreed with Lee that prediction markets are great, but when it comes to sports gambling, society has to get its arms around it. It's going to ruin sports and ruin a lot of young men's lives. As a quick aside, if you want to hear more of what Michael Lewis has to say about online sports betting, go on Spotify and listen to his 10-part series on his Against the Rules podcast. You'll certainly find out what he thinks about sports betting and its ultimate effect on society. Now we're going to talk a little more about the Super Bowl and the business aspects of the Super Bowl. In this case, an article by Justin Birnbaum from Fortune magazine dated February 9th. Meet the billionaire owners facing off in Super Bowl 60. Robert Kraft knows a thing or two about winning, considering on Sunday his New England Patriots will play in the Super Bowl for the 11th time since he bought the franchise in 1994. No other NFL owner comes close to that total. Second place is shared by the Pittsburgh Steelers' Rooney family and the San Francisco 49ers' DeBartolo York family, with 8 appearances in football's biggest game. And if Kraft's squad can outlast the Seattle Seahawks in Super Bowl 60, the Patriots will become the first NFL franchise to collect a 7th Lombardi trophy, breaking a tie they've shared with the Steelers since 2019. Regardless of the outcome on the field, though, Kraft has already won. Rising from a humble upbringing in suburban Boston, the 84-year-old is now worth an estimated $13.8 billion, landing at number 78 on the 2025 Forbes 400, the definitive ranking of the richest Americans. He owes much of that wealth to the astonishing growth of the Patriots, the NFL's fourth most valuable franchise, worth an estimated $9 billion, including debt, a massive jump from the $172 million Kraft paid 3 decades ago. If history is any indication, they're not done running up the score. Since 1998, when Forbes started valuing NFL franchises, teams have appreciated more than 2,300% on average, from $288 million to $7.1 billion, thanks in a large part to skyrocketing media rights fees that netted each club an estimated $392 million last season. The Seahawks, most recently valued by Forbes at $6.7 billion, 14th in the NFL, are expected to keep that momentum going this year. Although the team said last week that it is not for sale, many league insiders believe the franchise will be put on the market at some point after the Super Bowl and fetch a record price for the control sale, likely exceeding $7 billion, and possibly, if the process produces a bidding war, much more. That's been the history of the NFL, says Mark Gannis, president of the consulting firm Sports Corp, which is often called the NFL's 33rd owner, because of his close ties to football's decision makers. Parties pay more because they see the business, the management, and the structure of the league being so strong That'll be worth more in the future than it is today. Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen purchased the Seahawks in 1997 for $194 million. And since his death in 2018, the team has been controlled by his estate, with his sister Jody serving as chairman of both the Seahawks and the NBA's Portland Trail Blazers. But Allen's will called for his sports assets to eventually be sold, and the proceeds donated to charity, which for years fueled speculation as to when the teams would be made available. The Trailblazers are expected to have a new owner soon, after announcing a deal with Carolina Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon in September for a reported $4.25 billion. Now, with the Seahawks on the verge of their second Super Bowl title, it appears their time has come. While Jody Allen won't see a dime of what is shaping up to be a record-setting transaction, the sale could raise price tags around the league and boost the fortunes of her fellow NFL owners, including Kraft's. For Kraft, the Patriots have always been personal, much to the chagrin of his father, who hoped his son would avoid playing sports altogether and become a rabbi. Kraft grew up a fierce fan of Boston teams. In 1971, more than a decade after he played halfback and safety at Columbia University, he brought home Patriots season tickets for his four sons. His late wife Myra thought it was a reckless use of money. "It was the only time in my life I ever heard her yell at him," Kraft's oldest son Jonathan, who is now the president of the Patriots, told Forbes for a 2005 profile. By then, Kraft could afford it. His father-in-law owned Rand Whitney, which turned paper into packaging for food, cosmetics, and toys. And in 1968, Kraft bought half the business in a leveraged buyout, picking up the rest just a few years later. The company would eventually integrate other lines of businesses, such as transportation and manufacturing of the paper his packaging business utilized. Today, the Kraft Group generates more than $6 billion in revenue, according to Forbes estimates, ranking number 95 on the 2025 Forbes list of America's top private companies. As his business grew, Kraft chased his passion, buying his first sports franchise in 1975, a professional tennis team called the Boston Lobsters that folded 3 years later. After attempts to acquire the Boston Red Sox and the Celtics proved fruitless, he embarked on a risky path toward ownership of the Patriots. It started with the land around the franchise stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts. Kraft purchased a 10-year option, which cost $1 million a year, to give him the first chance at buying the real estate for $18 million. 3 years later, he bought the actual stadium alongside a partner for $25 million. So in 1993, when then-Patriots owner James Bush Orthwine decided he wanted to move the Patriots to St. Louis or sell the team, Kraft held the power. Anyone who wanted to buy the franchise, including suitors like current Philadelphia Eagles owner Jeff Lurie and novelist Tom Clancy, had to negotiate with him first. Instead, Kraft flew to St. Louis and negotiated his own purchase of the Patriots in 1994, paying what was then an NFL record at $172 million. These deals, in a final analysis, have to be principle to principle, says Sports Corp's Gannis, who was a member of the Clancy Group that was pursuing the franchise at the time. Bob knew that. He knew how to close deals. Over the next few decades, Kraft not only moved the Patriots into a new stadium, but also oversaw one of the most successful runs in professional sports history. Behind legendary quarterback Tom Brady and head coach Bill Belichick, New England posted 19 consecutive winning seasons from 2001 to 2019, collecting 17 AFC East division titles and claimed victory in 6 Super Bowls while appearing in 2 others. Yet Kraft's tenure hasn't been without controversy. The Patriots were fined and lost two draft picks on two separate occasions, once following the 2007 season, when they were found to have illegally recorded the New York Jets' defensive signals, and another in the Deflategate scandal, when the franchise was accused of using underinflated footballs in the 2014 AFC Championship game to attain a competitive advantage. Kraft also faced misdemeanor solicitations of prostitution charges in 2019 after visiting a massage parlor in Jupiter, Florida. These charges were dropped after the evidence was ruled inadmissible. Still, Kraft's influence on the NFL has been monumental in areas including labor relations, international expansion, and media rights. Notably, he helped bring CBS back into the fold after Fox poached the league's media rights in the early 1990s. Kraft also long served on and currently chairs the NFL's broadcast committee. But those contributions aside, Kraft will have to wait at least another year to be enshrined in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, falling short in a vote by the 50-person panel for the class of 2026. If it weren't for Paul Allen, the Seahawks might have departed Seattle decades ago. The franchise was previously owned by real estate developer Ken Behring, who was dissatisfied with its stadium, the Kingdome, and hatched a plan to relocate the Seahawks to Los Angeles, even transferring team operations to Anaheim in 1996. The move, however, was thwarted by the Kingdome lease, which was set to run until 2005, and threats of daily six-figure fines from the NFL. Luckily for the league, Allen was ready to step in when it effectively forced a sale. The Seattle native had amassed a fortune co-founding Microsoft with Bill Gates. Even though he left the company in 1975 after being diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, and he'd already pushed into sports ownership, buying the NBA's Trailblazers in 1988 for $70 million. So, a year after the failed move to Los Angeles, Allen took the Seahawks off Behring's hands, cutting a check that valued the franchise at a then-record $194 million. The sale completely altered the trajectory of the franchise. Allen helped deliver the Seahawks a new building that opened in 2002, contributing $130 million of the $430 million that it took to build what is now called Lumen Field. Seattle, which had reached the NFL postseason only four times from its inception in 1976 to the ownership change in 1997, also became a perennial playoff team. Under Allen, the Seahawks reached the Super Bowl twice, winning their first and only title in February 2014, behind head coach Pete Carroll, quarterback Russell Wilson, and the ferocious Legion of Boom defense. At the league level, though, Gannis recalls Allen being one of the less involved principal owners. He didn't come to many of the owners' meetings, Gannis said, but he came when he was asked to come, and when he did, his voice was outsized. Both the league's 2011 labor dispute and the NFL's return to Los Angeles were issues that Allen played an influential role in resolving, Gannis notes. Allen, who had an estimated net worth of $20.3 billion, died in 2018 from complications of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, while his sister, Jody, overseeing his estate as its executor. The Seahawks have remained quite successful. The team won an NFC West division title in 2020 and tied for the NFL's best record this season behind a resurgent quarterback Sam Darnold and head coaching phenom Mike McDonald. Jody's a fantastic owner, steadfast in what she believed, McDonald said this week. I love having Jody as our owner. She won't remain in control much longer, however. The NFL's ownership rules prohibit estates, foundations, or trust from holding equity stakes in franchises. And the timing for a sale is even more opportune. A provision from the construction of Lumen Field would have compelled the Seahawks to share 10% of the sales proceeds with the state of Washington. But that requirement has now expired. Generally, Gana says, these processes take 6 months to a year to play out. And the expectation is that the Seahawks won't officially be on the block until the Blazers deal closes, which is expected to happen this spring. Allen's 25% stake in the MLS's Seattle Sounders is also on the market. However long it takes, one thing is clear. Win or lose on Sunday, the Seahawks are headed toward an NFL record. I think people should be disappointed if it doesn't sell for at least $8 billion, Gannis says. And knowing that all the money's going to charity, it'd be awfully nice if the numbers started with a 10. Here's another article on athletes and money, this time Olympic athletes. Article by Brett Knight and Justin Birnbaum from Fortune magazine, dated February 9th. The highest paid athletes at the 2026 Winter Olympics. The Milan Cortina Winter Olympics will feature roughly 2,900 competitors from more than 90 countries participating in 116 events. And for most of those athletes, even some of those destined to become champions, their chosen sport isn't paying the bills. In fact, factoring in substantial travel and training costs, athletic glory on a global stage might come at a net loss. But at the 2026 Games, which officially began with Friday's opening ceremony, there is a select group of athletes who can easily afford the price of gold. For one thing, while the Winter Olympics won't have the NBA, golf, and tennis stars whose outsized paychecks loom over the Summer Games and frequently place them on the annual Forbes list of the world's highest paid athletes, the men's hockey tournament in Milan will include 146 players from the NHL, the league which hadn't allowed its players to take Olympic ice since 2014. Has a minimum salary of $775,000 this season, and 9 of the 10 members of Forbes' ranking of the NHL's highest-paid players, which also accounts for endorsements and other business income, are set to suit up over the next 2 weeks. The lone exception is New York Rangers goaltender Igor Shosturkin, whose native Russia is barred from the event because of the war in Ukraine. Topping that list of hockey players is Team USA forward Austin Matthews, whom the Toronto Maple Leafs are paying more than $15 million this season, and who also earns an estimated $5 million off the ice. Even that $20 million total, however, isn't enough to make him this year's highest-paid Olympia. That honor belongs to Eileen Gu, an American-born freestyle skier, who represents her mother's native China in international competition. Forbes estimates that the 22-year-old marketing superstar has hauled in $23 million off the slopes over the past 12 months, along with around $100,000 in prize money. Gu and her fellow Olympians could further boost their bottom lines with a podium performance this month. Endorsement contracts in Olympic sports sometimes contain financial incentives for athletes who win medals, and a victory can attract new sponsors, such as Wheaties, in the afterglow of the games. In addition, certain countries are willing to pay their athletes bonuses for capturing medals. The U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, for instance, has pledged $37,500 for every gold, $22,500 for every silver, and $15,000 for every bronze at this year's games. For athletes from host country Italy, the figures range from about $71,000 to $213,000, and two other delegations are willing to shell out nearly $800,000 for a champion. The Americans stand to profit from just showing up, though. After Ross Stevens, founder and CEO of asset manager Stone Ridge, donated $100 million to the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee last year. Each U.S. Olympic and Paralympic athlete will eventually receive $200,000, regardless of their results in the game. Here are the highest-paid athletes from five high-profile sports being contested at the Milan Cortina Winter Olympics. Freestyle skiing, Eileen Gu, $23 million. Hockey, Austin Matthews, $20 million. Alpine skiing, Lindsey Vonn, $8 million. Now we're going to talk a little bit about Lindsey Vonn here. Vonn, who worked with more than a dozen brands, including Delta Airlines, Land Rover, and Rolex, edges out her American teammate, Michaela Schifrin, in the financial race. Forbes estimates that the 30-year-old slalom champion, who's won three medals across the three Olympic appearances, has more than doubled her income since the 2022 Games to roughly $7 million annually. Snowboarding, Chloe Kim, $4 million. Figure skating, Ilya Malinin, $700,000. Malinin has been building up his endorsement portfolio since claiming gold at the 2024 World Championships. His partners now include Coca-Cola, Samsung, and Honda. And as he takes the ice on Saturday in the team figure skating event, he's posed for a star turn in Milan that could catapult him into a new marketing stratosphere. We're going to leave the world of sports behind now and talk about consumer spending in the United States. This article's from Fortune magazine and the Associated Press. It's dated February 10th. Title of the article is "Economists Surprised by Consumer Spending Screeching Halt in December." Shoppers unexpectedly paused their spending in December from November, closing out the holiday shopping season and the year on a lackluster tone. The report issued by the Commerce Department on Tuesday surprised economists who were looking for growth despite mounting concerns about slowing job growth, uncertainty about President Donald Trump's tariffs, and other economic headwinds. And it raised questions about shoppers' ability to spend after they've remained resilient for months despite souring consumer confidence, economists say. Retail sales were flat in December from November, when business was up 0.6%. According to the Commerce Department, economists were expecting a 0.4% increase for December. The retail sales figures, which are not adjusted for inflation, showed that many types of businesses posted declines, including furniture and home furnishing stores and electronics and appliance retailers. Among the few bright spots, building materials and garden stores, which posted a solid sales increase. Gas stations and food and beverage stores saw small sales gains. The snapshot offers only a partial look at consumer spending and doesn't include many services, including travel and hotel lodges. But the loan services category, restaurants, registered a dip of 0.1%. The data comes as U.S. consumer confidence has been souring for months. In fact, confidence declined sharply in January, hitting the lowest level since 2014, as Americans grow increasingly concerned about their financial prospects. Consumer spending has finally caught up with consumer sentiment, and not in a good way, Chris Zaccarelli, Chief Investment Officer for Northlight Asset Management, in Charlotte, North Carolina, wrote in a report published Tuesday. He noted that consumer confidence numbers have been disappointing for months, and shoppers have been complaining about the cost of everything, and yet they kept spending. But, he added, this month's data shows that consumers are no longer relentlessly increasing their level of spending. Thomas Ryan, North American economist at Capital Economics, also noted the report was worrisome, but given expected stimulus from the bigger tax refund checks, he thinks that consumption at the end of the first quarter of this year may turn out to be a lot stronger than it currently looks at the start. Economists will be closely monitoring a slew of economic reports on jobs and prices due out later this week. But the economy is in a confusing place. growth is robust. Gross domestic product, the nation's output of goods and services, advanced from July through September at the fastest pace in 2 years. But the job market is lackluster. Employers have added just 28,000 jobs a month since December. In the 2021 to 2023 hiring boom that followed COVID-19 lockdowns, by contrast, they were creating 400,000 jobs a month. When the agency releases hiring and unemployment numbers for January on Wednesday, they are expected to show that businesses, government agencies, and nonprofits added about 80,000 jobs last month, modest, but up from 50,000 in December. Analysts will also be studying Consumer Price Report to be released Friday. In December, consumer prices matched the 0.3% increase in November. If inflation cools in the coming months, it could increase the likelihood that the Federal Reserve will reduce its key interest rate later this year, economists say. Against this backdrop, some chains like Walmart, whose everyday low prices have pulled shoppers in from rivals, are thriving, but others struggle. A growing number of retailers are closing stores as companies reorganize under bankruptcy protection or pare down their operations to focus on profitable operations. On Monday, the operator of roughly 180 Eddie Bauer stores across the U.S. and Canada filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, blaming declining sales and a litany of other industry headwinds. Last month, the parent company of Saks Fifth Avenue said it was seeking bankruptcy protection, buffeted by rising competition and the massive debt it took on to buy its rival in the luxury sector, Neiman Marcus, just over a year ago. A few days later, the parent company said it was closing most of its Saks Off Fifth stores. Amazon said earlier this month that it was closing almost all of its Amazon Go and Amazon Fresh locations within days as it narrows its focus on food delivery at its grocery chain, Whole Foods Market. So, for those of you that follow Bitcoin, what's been going on lately? At one time, it was $125,000. Then it went down to $60,000. What's the reason behind this massive swing? Here's an article by Jeff John Roberts from Fortune magazine dated February 9th. What caused the massive Bitcoin crash? Clues point to a blow-up at a Hong Kong hedge fund. Crypto prices got absolutely rocked this week when Bitcoin falling nearly $15,000 in 24 hours. A bloodbath not seen since the collapse of crypto con man Sam Bankman-Fried's empire back in 2022. On Friday, Bitcoin had clawed back most of those losses and is now trading around $70,000. But the episode has left even longtime crypto insiders asking each other, what just happened? There are plenty of theories swirling around, but one is particularly compelling. The cause of the crash lies with Hong Kong traders who placed high-leverage Bitcoin bets that went horribly wrong. The theory was put forth on X by Parker White, a former equities trader who's now chief operating officer at a crypto firm called DeFi Development Corporation. In a long thread, White said there is evidence pointing to the sudden implosion of Hong Kong hedge funds that held call options in BlackRock's IVIT, which is the world's largest Bitcoin ETF. White suggests that the hedge funds used the yen carry trade, a form of interest arbitrage, to finance big positions in out-of-the-money IVIT options. This amounted to a risky bet that Bitcoin prices, which have been slumping since a big sell-off in October, would recover. The hoped-for rally did not arrive, however. Meanwhile, White speculates that Hong Kong funds also got pummeled by headwinds in the yen carry trade, which made their financing move more expensive, and exposure to recent convulsions in the silver market. The upshot is the hedge funds faced a perfect storm And as the crypto market slumped further this week, the value of their holdings declined until they got liquidated, forcing the massive sell-off of IBIT shares and a calamitous fall for Bitcoin. Here's how White explained what happened in trader speak. Now, I could easily see how the funds could have been running a levered options trade on IBIT. Think way OTM calls equal ultra high gamma, with borrowed capital in JPY. October 10th could very well have blown a hole in their balance sheet that they tried to win back by adding leverage, waiting for the obvious rebound. As that led to increased losses coupled with increased funding costs in JPY, I could see how the funds would have gotten more desperate and hopped on the silver trade. When that blew up, things got dire, and this last push in BTC finished them off. In his post, White also pointed out that the Hong Kong hedge funds, whose Bitcoin trading occurred only in the form of ETF shares, are not part of the traditional crypto ecosystem. This means that chatter about their predicament did not bubble up on crypto Twitter, which is the go-to forum for industry news, and nor did it create counterparties who incurred big losses and would be likely to warn others. White's theory is just that. Of course, it is no more than a theory. Meanwhile, history shows that major Bitcoin crashes have typically been touched off by multiple factors, not a single event. And indeed, this week's crypto crackup coincided with a broader AI-related asset sell-off, uncertainty over the fate of a key blockchain bill, as well as crypto names appearing in the Epstein files, factors that all likely contributed to Thursday's meltdown. Still, White's explanation is the most persuasive and is further supported by other circumstantial evidence, including a recent decision by the Securities and Exchange Commission to lift limits on trading Bitcoin options. Meanwhile, other longtime crypto figures expressed cautious support for the Hong Kong hedge fund theory. That included the respective venture capitalist Haseeb Qureshi, who described the theory as plausible, but added that it may take some months to wait for regulatory filings that could help confirm it, and that in some cases, a crypto player can blow up without anyone ever learning their identity. But for those who are confident that a hedge fund is at the root of this week's market troubles, there's already a Polymarket forum to bet on the culprit. Let's change the subject completely. No more Bitcoin. Now we're going to talk about Disney and its recent selection of an executive to take the place of Bob Iger. The article's by Claire Zillman from Fortune magazine, dated February 9th. You vanquished your rival in a CEO succession race. Now, how do you lead them? Disney this week announced Josh D'Amaro, its parks chief, as the winner of its very public race to be its next CEO. He'll take over for the outgoing chief executive Bob Iger in March. But along with the glory of the CEO crown and the monumental task of running the complex entertainment giant, D'Amaro faces a tricky personnel challenge, becoming the boss of his former peer, Dana Walden. Disney's TV and entertainment chief was reportedly a fellow CEO contender he beat out for the job. The Fortune 500 is littered with examples of wannabe CEOs who left their companies after being passed over for the top job, and leaving can be a natural response to such a snub. Famously, when GE named Jeff Immelt CEO in 2001, the three other internal candidates eventually departed for the company for top jobs elsewhere. Former Apple retail chief Ron Johnson left to become CEO at JCPenney when the tech giant named Tim Cook CEO in 2011. Just last month, Walmart announced that its international CEO, Catherine McClay, considered a CEO contender, was leaving the company following the appointment of John Furner as the retail giant's next chief. But in Disney's case, Walden seems likely to stick around at least for a while. In announcing tomorrow as CEO, Disney also promoted Walden, a respected Hollywood insider, to President and Chief Creative Officer. She's the first to hold that title in the company's 102-year history, and it gives her oversight of all Disney's movies and streaming series. Along with praising Walden's creative and storytelling bona fides, the Disney press release notes that she will report directly to Amaro, the guy who beat her out for the CEO job. And there's the rub. Even for the most self-assured executives, that dynamic could prove awkward. The CEO runner-up has to nurse a dented ego while answering to the succession race's ultimate winner. The incoming CEO, meanwhile, has to manage a team that includes someone who wanted their job. On paper, at least, Disney has set up DeMauro and Walden to navigate the many pitfalls such a scenario poses by giving the new CEO and chief creative officer roles that are distinct and complementary. She's on the creative side, whereas DeMauro is more on the financial side and park side, says Susan Sandlin, a managing director at Pearl Meyer, who leads the firm's leadership consulting practice. Walden brings value in a whole different way than DeMauro does, she says. In combination, it's a pretty powerful team. It could be argued that Disney's new double-barrel leadership arrangement, which draws on the executive strengths, is akin to a co-CEO structure, but better, Sundland says. You have one reporting to the other, she says. The minute you have equal CEOs, you're begging for ambiguity and potential conflict. Still, distinct titles and designated realms of influence won't guarantee a smooth partnership. The onus is on DeMauro to settle on a common shared goal that he can rally his new team around and to delegate meaningful tasks to Walden, says Emma Zhao, an assistant professor of commerce at UVA's McIntyre School of Commerce. That helps put aside some of those individual concerns and motivations. A wild card in all of this, of course, is Walden's personal feelings about the situation, her ambition, and whether she's determined to one day be a CEO. If that's the case, her new position and a one-time award with a target value of $5.26 million may only keep her at Disney for so long. Sandland, who's counseled executives in Walden's position before, suggests her best strategy is to sit tight. My advice is don't make any rash moves right now. A lot of people will be calling you for other CEO roles, which you could jump at immediately, she says. But if an executive really likes where they are, they love the culture, they've been there a long time, then they often want to see what can the company do that would make it worth sticking around. Again, to change the subject entirely, with all the dispute internationally about tariffs and the increasing levels of U.S. debts, how does this affect the way foreign investors think about U.S. securities? Here's an article that deals with that. It's by Eleanor Pringle, Fortune Magazine, February 9th. Investors are already nervy about international buyers backing away from U.S. debt. China might be beginning to do just that. If there's one thing that catches the attention of the second Trump administration, it's how foreign investors behave toward U.S. assets. Perhaps most noticeably, it's their attitude toward the safe haven of U.S. treasuries. Last month, Deutsche Bank earned the ire of Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent after one of its analysts suggested foreign investors may leverage their holdings of U.S. borrowing and equities against the White House's threat of the sovereignty of Greenland. While Bessent dismissed the irrelevance of Denmark's holdings of American debt, Trump eased up on his tariff rhetoric after the bond markets hiccuped. The Trump administration is therefore unlikely to be pleased with reports this week that Chinese banks have been urged to limit their holdings of U.S. treasuries. Bloomberg reported this morning, citing unnamed sources, that Chinese regulators had advised financial institutions against holding large amounts of U.S. government debt because of questions about volatility and security. Minding the Bloomberg report, UBS's Paul Donovan noted this morning that it is nevertheless of note that foreign investors are being advised to rethink their strategy. He said the report does not include the official holdings, and China's banks are not major players in the U.S. Treasury market. Nonetheless, the idea that international investors may be less inclined to buy U.S. Treasuries in the future without dumping existing holdings is getting attention in markets. China is the third largest holder of U.S. Treasuries. Indeed, any jitters in China are only playing into wider questions about whether investors should be hedging themselves against headwinds to the dollar. As Chris Turner, ING's global head of markets, wrote this morning, mainland China and Hong Kong together hold $938 billion of U.S. Treasuries as of last November. Comments like these come at a vulnerable time for the dollar, when the dollar diversification theme is rife. China could not inflict the level of damage on the U.S. bond market that other nations might theoretically wield. Japan, for instance, holds nearly double the amount of treasuries that China owns, with the U.K. also owning some $888 billion in U.S. borrowing as well. Brazil, for example, held $229 billion in American treasuries in November 2024, and 12 months later, this had slipped to $168 billion. In India, November 2024 saw the nation holding $234 billion in treasury holdings, and by November 2025, this had reduced to $186.5 billion. Note, China has followed a similar but not identical path. In November 2024, it owned $776 billion in U.S. treasuries, which steadily increased to more than $900 billion in August 2025. A rundown then ensued to $888.5 billion as of November 2025. As Innes McPhee, CEO of Oxford Economics, stated to Fortune magazine, "I think what happened last year was a sudden realization of we still wanted to be exposed to the U.S. We don't want to sell off our holdings in such a fast-growing economy, but we do want to hedge our exposure. And so what you saw amongst a lot of pension funds around the world that invest in U.S. assets was a hedging of that exposure. That's how you can have a situation where the dollar falls, but there is no capital outflow." For years, people have talked about China weaponizing its holdings of U.S. treasuries. I don't think there's much credibility in those sorts of statements. And folks, with that, we are done for the day. Thank you so much for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World. I'm Steve Klein. Please drop by next Monday at 11, and we'll do this again. Thanks so much. Have a good day.